had mentioned, boy, she didn't say it like this, but almost like the undertone was, man, you're throwing a lot of stuff at us. So I'm sorry. Excuse me, but sometimes it's worth, some of you have heard this before and you may not make the connection, and sometimes hearing it again, if you haven't heard it before, and it's just not deep enough to make connections, think of it as leaving an imprint in your mind. Sort of like when you paint fresh wood, bare wood, you have to put on a primer, and after a couple hours it sort of fades. But without that primer, the next coat, which may be the final coat, wouldn't be as vibrant. That would also fade. So think of this as kind of your primer coat of some of these concepts if you have not heard before, if I have not given enough detail for you to see, you know, some reality of that. Okay? Is that okay? Okay. So I want to read another one to you here. Now, again, is this the one? Yeah. From the leaves of the tree, of the heaven tree. So that's not the name of the Sanskrit or the Buddhist or the Tibetan text. Not that you will remember this, but just if it's on the soundtrack, maybe someone can look it up. It's based on Shemendra's Bodhisattva Avadana Kalpalata. So Avadana is talking about, is another word. There in the Hindu tradition also, Avadanas are life stories. So this has 108 of these Buddhist stories. So this is the story called the Generosity of King Sri Sena, the second of these 108 in this volume. That would be in this tanka, I think it would be represented for this area. If you have each of the tankas represents two or three or four of these. So long ago, the city named Arista had wealth and glory that rivaled the splendor of the gods. When it says long ago or time long ago, it might be in other universes. You know, this is not, from Buddha's perspective, not just this earth, even other universes before. You know, when we talk in Western cosmology, we talk about the Big Bang and the evolution of the earth, and then maybe eventually there'll be a time when it collapses again or disappears. From a Buddhist perspective, world systems come and go. We are in a period of abidance right now, stability, but eventually this world system will disappear. And in other world systems, many, many eons ago, completely different universe, you might say, these different things happened. Our mind streams are not limited to this area of space or to this world system. It depends on our karma. Once when Moggallana's mother died, remember the two disciples, Shariputra and Moggallana, of the Buddha? Shariputra was foremost in what? Do you remember?
Wisdom.
Moggallana was foremost in what?
Method.
What? Method. No. Clever, go wisdom and method. No. What?
Morality?
No. Magic, psychic powers. Psychic powers. So Moggallana, he tried to see where his mother was born with his divine eye. You know, divine eye doesn't mean this eye, it means like capacity of wisdom to see distant places. Couldn't see where mom was born. He had to be born somewhere in samsara, but he couldn't see everything because he was not yet omniscient. He was an arhat. So he asked the Buddha, and the Buddha said, yes, your mother was born in the universe, in the northern direction called something, something. It's one of the examples in the Abhidharma. We were talking about Abhidharma earlier. In the Abhidharma, it mentions that the Buddha is superior to the arhats because he's unimpeded in seeing distant places, knowing distant times, and different things like this. Whereas in the Mahayana, generally we say the Buddha's omniscience far surpasses those mere qualities. But at any rate, when it says here, long ago, this is maybe just brief, who knows how long, it's not saying how many kalpas. Sometimes the Buddha gave, 230,000 kalpas in the past. It's long ago, might be longer than that. In a city named Arista, that had wealth and glory that rivaled the splendor of the gods, the city was ruled by King Srisena, who was ornamented with all virtues. He delighted in benefiting beings by giving from his coffers, his treasury. He was also wise, upright, honest, and a great leader in all ways. Endowed with such kingly qualities, he did not know even the words for sin or unhappiness. And his land was truly equal to the eternal city of the gods. He did not even know the words for sin or unhappiness. That'd be nice, huh? Looking down upon King Srisena, Chakra, king of the gods. Who's Chakra, by the way? What's another name for Chakra? Have you heard of Chakra? Who's there's another name you might know. Indra. So when Buddha first attained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, you know the story, right? After he arose, he thought to himself, the Dharma that I've realized is so profound, but so subtle that the people in the world whose eyes are, clouded by the dust of ignorance, couldn't perceive, so I won't talk about it. I'm not going to give any teachings. For 7 weeks, I think, he was there. Finally, he was requested by Indra and Brahma. So, I mentioned who Brahma was. In the form realm, the king of the fourth concentration, the fourth dhyana, the fourth jhana, in the actual physical Brahma realm, is called Brahma, the creator. He's called that because at the beginning of a universe, when a universe comes into existence, the Brahma realm is the first one, when the physical universe is there and then sentient beings begin to populate the various realms. The Brahma realm is the first one populated. The first one populated there, like, I'm here, then everything else comes as he thinks, I'm the creator. Some people have said that may be the origin of the Christian, or you say the Judaic, what it was said, the peoples of the book, tradition of the creator God. Maybe they think that's, maybe their God is Brahma. Who knows? So, endowed with such kingly qualities, he did not know even the words for sin or unhappiness. His land was truly equal to the eternal city of the gods. Looking upon King Srisena, Chakra, it's Indra, king of the gods. So what's the difference between Indra and Brahma? Brahma's the king of the fourth, the resident of the fourth Brahma realm, the fourth dhyana. Indra is the highest of the various level of the devas of the desire realm. The king and the top level of the desire realm is Indra. He has an elephant. He's very powerful. So those two gods are the ones that came down and requested Buddha. There are some people whose eyes, wisdom eyes, are not, veiled by so much ignorance. You can, there's great value. Please turn the wheel of Dharma. So here's Chakra, king of the gods, thought, the moral virtue of this king seems equal to my own. He's a pretty virtuous guy. His generosity is renowned throughout the world. To see whether or not he actually has such strength of character, I think I will go and beg the king for his body. When I go to the land of men, I will take along a small entourage of gods to witness. In the meanwhile, the minister entrusted with guarding the kingdom, a wise man named Rajyarakashguru, long one. Excuse my pronunciation. Sometimes Rachel Maddow says, I've murdered that name. When she, someone from Poland, or some, you know, these Russian oligarchs. If I had time to read it carefully, I wouldn't do such a bad job. He had such an ominous dream that he had once told the king, "Alas, your majesty, the fame of your generosity has become very great. The god Chakra is jealous and coming here to ask for your majesty's body. The king in his generosity would give away everything he has. For a renunciate, this is the correct way to act." Remember, we were talking at lunch about even giving your family away, which is kind of beyond the scope of some of us. But a king is a guardian jewel to his people, and he should not even think of giving away his life or those of his wife and children. This is like, I think Susie wrote this. "Do not take joy in what would be our deprivation." Yeah, he should not even think of giving away his life or those of his wife and children. Okay. "The king showed his beautiful white, the king showed his beautiful white teeth in a smile and replied, "My minister, you are wise. You would help me, I know. But who could turn their back on anyone pleading to be given what they are mentally dying for? Even for me to hear your words suggesting that I stop giving what people desire is to hear you ask me to live, but to live as a life, to live as lifeless as a corpse. You know, I live to give." Essentially, right? Of the six perfections of the Bodhisattva, the first that they develop a special practice of is generosity, giving. Even like Shariputra had not yet reached the point where he could give his body. And because he didn't do it at the right time, he lost his bodhicitta. But once that bodhicitta is stable, one can even give one's own body for others. "Beggars come here hoping to obtain one thing or another. If I were to leave them hopeless, how could I live? If there's someone I can help, I'm happy even if my body comes to harm." When the king said all this with great firmness, the minister realized he would not listen to reason, to the minister's reason, to Susie's reason, and grew greatly disheartened. Now, a wise and learned Brahmin lives close by in a forest. One day he happened to see the king's wife, Queen Jayaprabha, who was very beautiful and virtuous. Because of various propensities carried over from previous lives, imprints, karmic imprints from previous lives, the Brahmin, although he lived free from attachments, desired her with all his heart. This same Brahmin had a disciple to whom he had taught all he knew. The disciple asked his master, "What can I offer you in return for what you have taught me?" The Brahmin who has attachment for the king's wife had a disciple. The disciple asked him, "What can I give you to pay you back for all that you've taught me?" The Brahmin replied, "I live in the forest, so I do not need any kind of wealth. But King Srisena has a wife named Jayaprabha. Should you bring her to me, that would be payment enough." So he kind of lost his way a bit. The disciple thought, "If I do not do this, my teacher will be displeased. If I take her, the king will punish me." You know, dilemma, right? Like the other dilemmas, you know, should I do right? Should I do the worldly thing or should I do the virtuous thing? What is to be done? But he went to the palace and the king, seeing a beggar, was delighted. So the disciple has gone to the palace. The king thinks he's a beggar. "What do you wish?" the king asked. "I cannot say," cried the Brahmin youth as he fell with his face to the ground. So what can he say? What does he want? Wants the king's wife, right, to give to his Brahmin teacher. "I will give you whatever you wish," the king said. "Tell me." And so the youth explained his dilemma to the king. Now the king loves his wife to distraction and could not bear to part with her. But he considered further, if he did not give up his wife, he would not be fulfilling the Brahmin's desires. What could he do? And so, standing firmly on his vow of generosity, he called in his queen and after explaining his problem to her, gave her to the Brahmin. This is a Brahmin youth who's going to give it to his teacher. King Jayaprabha was wild with terror. Her eyes flickered anxiously at the Brahmin, like the eyes of a wild animal trapped in a lair. Although the king and queen truly loved one another, they were unattached to all desires. But most others are different. Because of women, many a man will give up his morality. And because of men, many a woman will give up their morality. Caught up in desire, many will give up their wealth. Others, abstemious practices, was that has to do with abstention, like their restraint. Others give up their religion. Others give up all shame. Still others will give up their bodies. But this king, having said he would part with this wondrous queen, gave her up without regret, like a dewdrop gathered from the grass. When the ladies of the city saw the Brahmin youth leading the queen away, they were so distraught they became frozen with fear. The youth led Queen Jayaprabha to his master, who upon seeing her was overcome with regret and shame. Alas, or in New York they say, oy vey. Lady, you are like a mother to all beings. It is not right for me to bring such hardship upon you. By the power of desire, I have lost all shame and moral standing. This action has ruined my reputation and thrown me into an abyss. I sincerely regret what I have done. Now do not despair. I will at once take you back to the king. The queen, feeling as if she had been brought back from the dead, rejoiced. In the meantime, Shakra had manifested as a Brahmin whose lower body was spilling forth blood and guts. The terrible apparition was being carried into the city on a litter borne by four men and chased by hordes of carnivorous birds and beasts, attracted by the smell of putrefying flesh. The people of the city who saw this shuddered and were left mute in horror. So this is not really happening. This is just Shakra appearing this way, right? He's going to test the king. The cripple was carried to the king, who could not bear to look upon this frightful creature, unable even to die. The king immediately asked him what it was he wished. The Brahmin haltingly whispered, like one barely able to speak, "In the forest, my stomach was ripped out and eaten by tigers. When I wondered what could be done to help me, a god in the sky told me that if there were someone who had no use for his body and would give it to another, it could be joined to mine and my life would be saved. It seemed impossible that there could be anyone who could give up his own happiness to help another. Who would do such a thing? The god replied that there was only one such person in the world. You, O king, having been born from previous merit. You are the last resort for the destitute and frightened. By beating the drum of your merit with the drumstick of giving, you are able to give life and body. The sweet sound of the drum rings out like the southern winds that carry the sweet smell of sandalwood everywhere. I go to you for refuge. From the clear, full moon of your face, your words shine like rays of light and fall like nectar. I pray that you will relieve me of the searing pain of my terrible afflictions." Whew. So this is all subterfuge, right? The king could not bear the Brahmin's suffering and at once replied, "May I relieve your suffering? Without hesitation, I will give half my body. The wise minister shook in body and mind. "Your majesty," he cried, "do not talk so rashly. Do not talk nonsense. As a king, you help all beings. To break the wish-granting gem, your body into fragments, would be to forsake your compassion for all other beings." A common refrain in these acts of giving. "The Brahmin is a demon in disguise. Do not let him transform the heart of the king." And then all the people of the land pleaded with the king, but he would not listen. The king then spoke the following to the minister and the people. "I remember now my previous life in which I produced the mind of enlightenment." The bodhicitta, right? He's a bodhisattva. "Long ago I sacrificed my body to others, and so now I am never ill. I remember giving my body without regret to prevent a tigress from eating her cubs. I also remember giving both my eyes to a blind man at the time I was born as a shibi," one of these previous civilizations, At another time, I protected a pigeon from a hawk by giving up my own body. I remember being King Chandraprabha and giving up my head to the fierce-eyed one. In other lives, I gave everything that I possessed. I gave even my wives and children. This time as well, nothing must hinder me from giving up my life and body. All those around the king felt their vision flicker as if they were dying. To perform the deed, the king selected a craftsman who sliced away at the king's body with a sharp saw. Finally, as the king's body was cut in half, earth shook, meteors shot across the sky, and the stars cried out and shed tears. The sun dimmed and as if obscured by dust, all the people wept and fainted. The king, however, smiled in delight. Although his body was cut in two, the lower part of the king's body was attached to the Brahmin, who was then made whole. The Brahmin stood up. Remember, the Brahmin said the bottom part of his body had been ravaged by tigers or something. The Brahmin stood up and joyfully praised the king. Shakra, astonished that the king did not regret his sacrifice. So who is Shakra in this story? He's manifesting as this person whose body wanted to be restored. He was astonished that the king did not regret his sacrifice, restored the king's body to its former state with magical elixir of the gods. From the sky, white flowers rained down. The earth itself moved to and fro as if swept up in festivities. All marveled, and as they were rejoicing, the other Brahmin returned to the palace with the queen. The Brahmin gave her back to the king, along with great praise, and all celebrated the outcome of the king's action. The king and his queen, full of love and compassion, continued to rule with the strength of virtue, filling all beings with happiness. The fame of the royal couple spread throughout their realm and beyond into the lands of gods and men. So this is, again, talking about generosity, perfection of giving, being able to give up even one's own body. When we talk in the the verse I think I was reciting to you before from Lama Chopa that we'll do on Thursday, I keep on mentioning that, so you might think, oh, I wasn't going to come to Lama Chopa, but now maybe I want to see those verses. So that's clever, huh? Just teasing. Please grant me blessings to perfect the practice of generosity by enhancing the mind of giving without attachment. My body, my wealth, even the possessions of my virtues of the three kinds, giving up even the karmic consequences of my actions, how I can enhance the mind of giving by imagining transforming these like a wish-fulfilling gem into whatever people want, whatever their object of desire is. That's why he's talking about to fulfill the objects of desire. Now, in a similar vein, but bringing up some other points, I want to read you another, I think I've read one from here, one called Prince Spasti. It's number 7. In this compendium. I think I saw it in one of the others, another version. Prince Spasti. What does Spasti mean? Or Swasti? You know the symbol, is it on here? Swastika?
Yeah.
So, actually in Sanskrit it's SV, but it, Even in the Hitler, is it called it swastika? They replaced the V by a W, right? What is it like? Sometimes people, some Indians, even nowadays, they don't always pronounce like Sanskrit. They'll say, what will they say? Wajra instead of Vajra or something like that. So, Swasti actually means auspicious. You know, at the end of text, sometimes it's just a word, Om Svasti, may it be auspicious, something like that. So, Prince Svasti. Thus I have heard at one time, upon a certain occasion, when the Enlightened One was residing in the bamboo grove of the Kalandaka bird, he put on his upper robe and lower robes, taking his alms bowl, went with Ananda to seek alms. I alluded to this the other day when I said many sutras begin this. The Buddha goes out for alms, comes back, eats, washes his feet, sits down and meditates, right? At that time in the city, there lived under a gatehouse belonging to a certain householder, a blind old couple who had no dwelling place, no property, and no food. They lived under the gatehouse. They're like, what do you call it? Homeless. Like in New York City, living under Trump Tower or something. The couple had a 7-year-old son who begged food, took it to the old man and woman, his mom and dad, and thus fed them. The best of the food he gave to his parents, the scraps he ate himself. When Ananda saw how this boy honored and cared for his parents, he was pleased and praised him. When the Buddha had returned from his alms round and had eaten, he taught the Dharma to the assembly. Then Ananda, kneeling and folding his palms in reverence, said to the Buddha, Lord, during the alms round, we saw a little boy who honored and cared for his parents by begging. When he received food or fruit or whatever that was given to him, he gave the best to them and ate the scraps himself. Nor does he do this for one day only, but all the time. And it would seem that this makes the boy happy. The Buddha said, Ananda, whenever anyone, whether a monk or nun or married person or whoever it may be, honors his or her parents and makes sacrifices for them, it is exceedingly difficult to calculate the merits that he gains. You may remember I mentioned we talked about the recipient of our generosity. Our parents are some of the heaviest objects because they've given us this body, this perfect human rebirth. They've taught us, they've guarded us, and so forth. So the karma that we create in caring for them, sacrificing for them, will enhance our ability to practice a spiritual path. It's difficult to calculate the merits that someone like this gains in honoring their parents, making sacrifices for them. Why is this? I recall that in eons long past, in a former birth, I honored my parents with loving thoughts and even sacrificed my own flesh for them. Because of this, I was liberated from the obstacles, and by the power of that root of virtue, I passed beyond the universal monarch's birth and an Indra's birth and became the supreme of the three worlds and attained Buddhahood. What does that mean? Oftentimes, when the Bodhisattva was doing these incredible acts of generosity or patience or keeping morality, strict morality, perseverance, people would ask him, why are you doing this? You want to become a universal king? You're collecting all this merit to become... Because some people will do that. That's their ambition. Or to become Indra, king of the desire realm gods. Yeah, why are you doing this? And the Bodhisattva would say, no. Leave that aside. I'm doing this to achieve the state of Buddhahood, to be able to help all sentient beings. That's the aim. So I passed beyond a universal monarch's birth, passed beyond Indra's birth, and became the supreme of the three worlds and attained Buddhahood. Ananda said, Lord, I beseech you to tell us how in time long past, in order to honor your parents, you sacrificed your own life and gave your own flesh and delivered them from the bonds of death. Excuse me. The Buddha said, Ananda, listen well and bear it in mind. Bear it in mind. Keep it in. Don't forget it. And I shall tell you. That's very important. Every sentence here gives us something to think about and practice. Ananda said, Lord, so be it. I'll do that. The Buddha said, Ananda, in eons long past, aeons past recall beyond conception, there was an emperor in this Jambudvipa. You know Jambudvipa? What does that mean? We say, and we make the mandala Zambuling. The Tibetans don't say Jambu, they say Zambu. Ling is Vipa. Ling means island. Vipa means island or landmass. Jambu means this continent, southern continent, is called Jambudvipa. Jambu is the name of a rose apple that supposedly is something indicative of this southern continent. So you could say this world system we live in, or just the southern continent, whatever. So long ago, in this Jambudvipa, there was an emperor by the name of Deva who lived in the country called Sribhadra. This emperor had 1,000 sons whom he established as kings in the 10 directions. The youngest son was named Virtuous, and he was made king of the land of the large-bodied people. He was devoted and honored and made offerings to the gods. He was devout and honored and made offerings to the gods. What's the land of the big, large-bodied people? When you talk about the four continents, you know, Lupakpo, this eastern continent, Lupakpo, Lu means body, Pakpo means, you know, exalted. I think since those beings have large bodies. It doesn't say the eastern direction, but I think that's... The emperor had a great minister called Rahula, who, because of his poisonous mind, murdered the emperor and usurped the throne and sent his soldiers in all directions to spy and to assassinate the kings. Remember the king who he had just assassinated? He had enshrined his sons as kings of the various places. One day when King Virtuous, one of the sons, had gone to the park to rest, a yaksha appeared to him from an opening in the ground, kneeling, and spoke, King, the minister Rahula, because of his poisonous mind, has murdered your father, the emperor, and your elder brothers. Now the soldiers are approaching to murder you too. You must find some means of escape. The king was exceedingly worried and began to make plans to escape that very night. Now this king had a son called Svasti, whom, because he was handsome and comely, If he wasn't handsome, he wouldn't have taken. Seeing them make haste, the queen said, My lord, what is the cause of your odd behavior and your hasty departure? The king replied, This is not for you to know. He wasn't going to take his wife. He was going to take his handsome son, comely. What does that mean, comely? Doesn't that mean... Oh, yeah, so handsome, sort of the same thing, maybe slightly, okay. So it's not comely, it's comely? Oh, okay. I always thought it was comely. Good. I learned something. Your odd behavior, hasty departure, the king replied, This is not for you to know. The queen said, My lord, for the sake of my peace of mind, whatever works are afoot, do not, I beg you, conceal them from me. The king replied, While I was in the park, a yaksha appeared to me and told me that the minister Rahula had killed my father and my elder brothers and that his soldiers are now coming to kill me and that I must find some means of escape. The queen knelt and said, Lord, I shall accompany you. I shall accompany you. Do not abandon me. The king took provisions for a week, loaded them on his back. Could we do that today? Maybe with condensed milk and stuff, easily. Yeah. The queen and his son and set out. They traveled for 12 days, but in their great haste, they lost their way, and the provisions ran out. Okay? Thereupon, the king thought, there's no other way. What do you say? I have to kill the queen and eat her flesh. It's if you're woke, don't tell this to anyone else. He's going to choose the wife first rather than the son. Sending the queen on ahead, he put the boy on his back, followed her, drew his sword, and as he was about to stab her, the son pressed his palms together and pleaded, "Father, I beseech you, do not kill the queen, my mother." Repeating this again and again, he sought to save his mother's life. Then he said, "Father, without killing me, cut off my flesh bit by bit and feed the three of us. If you kill me, the flesh will become wormy and spoil. So just cut it off piece by piece." It's a little bit like, you know, in the boats in the past, they sometimes would bring a big turtle or tortoise, and they just cut off a little of the flesh to put in the soup. It would stay alive. Otherwise, if you kill the animal, the meat would spoil very soon. The king then cut off bits of the boy's flesh and nourished them each day, the three of them, and when the flesh had been eaten, sucked the marrow from the bones. As they were about to abandon the boy, he said, "Father and mother, my body has become weakened. Give me a little of the flesh, then go on." His own flesh. "I beg you." The father and mother divided the flesh into three parts, each took one part and gave one part to the boy and went on. The son then made the following wish prayer. "By the merit of having offered the flesh of my own body to my father and mother, may I attain enlightenment and deliver all beings in the 10 directions from their many sufferings and lead them to nirvana." Immediately, all the realms of the three great kiliocosms trembled in six ways. Oh, kiliocosms. You know what that means? That's a little bit of a neologism. Edward Conza, a famous translator, translated a particular term, and I can't remember off the top of my head the Sanskrit, but in Tibetan we say Tongsum, the great Tongsum Chembo, or Tongsum, the 3,000 worlds. So it doesn't mean 3,000. In modern mathematical notation, you say 10 cubed. So, or 1,000 cubed, sorry. What is 1,000 cubed? What is 1,000 squared? 1,000 is
a million.
1,000 cubed is another 1,000 billion. So sometimes it says the billion world systems. Sometimes it's concepts sort of try to make it into sort of like Greek trikiliocosm, the great 3,000. Here, this translator, Stanley Fry, just said kiliocosm, like 1,000 world system. So the 3,000 means not 3,000 world systems. It means 1,000 world systems is your base. Take 1,000 of those, if you can imagine, when you're making a mandala offering, you can do this. You're offering 1,000, like in the Lama Tropa, it says, Shewatake Nishi Lumboche, it says 10 million. Shewatake Nishi Lumboche. Shewatake. Actually, Shewa means 10 million, Take means, enough to make it a billion. So essentially you're offering a billion world systems when you offer the mandala. Where were they? Immediately all the realms of the three great kiliocosms trembled in six ways. All the gods from their palaces in the realms of desire to the realm of form, so Indra and Brahma realms, all the gods in their palaces in the realm of desire and the realm of form ask what such a sign portended, all this moving around. Looking with their divine eye, they saw that the earth and firmament trembled because on earth the bodhisattva had cut his flesh from his own body and sacrificed it to his parents and offered this sacrifice to attain perfect Buddhahood and to deliver all beings. Then the gods descended from the firmament and let fall a shower of tears. Thereupon Indra, the lord of the gods of desire realm, in order to test the boy, transformed himself into a beggar, took the boy's hand and begged for its flesh. Boy, he's almost bones. The father had been sucking the marrow out of his bones. He's only got a hand. So Indra's asking him to give the hand to him. Then, transforming himself into a tiger and a lion, Indra came to devour the boy. The boy thought, since these beasts of prey desire to eat me, I shall give them what flesh and bones and marrow that are still left in my body. With this thought, he became joyful, and every thought of regret left him. When Indra saw that the boy's mind was irreversible and firm, he changed himself back into his own form and spoke to him. Son, do you desire to attain the birth of Indra, the Lord of the gods, that you have so devotedly sacrificed your own flesh for your parents? If not, do you wish to become a Mara king or a Brahma king? Remember, I said sometimes they'll say, what are you doing all these meritorious deeds for? You want these great worldly boons? The boy replied, Indra, I have no desire for the pleasures of the three worlds. I wish to attain Buddhahood and to liberate countless beings. Indra said, surely you regret having sacrificed the flesh from your own body for the sake of your parents. The boy replied, I feel no regret, not even so much as the tip of a hair. Indra said, seeing your body without flesh, who could believe that you experience no regrets? The boy replied, if, in truth, I have no regrets, and if I am able to attain perfect Buddhahood, may my body become as it was before, invoking the words of truth. When he said this, his body became as it was formerly. Thereupon Indra and the other gods lauded him and all exclaimed in one voice, excellent, excellent. I remember once when Lama Yeshe was alive, we're talking about what would you do if you encountered a lion in the desert is coming toward you, or in the forest, lion or tiger, and someone said, I would take refuge. Because we had been taught refuge, that's what you do, right? Take refuge in Buddha-Dharma. And I remember a lama said, would you give your body to that? Because there are many, this is one of the examples, maybe Lama was thinking of this, or the time that the Bodhisattva gave his body to the tigress who couldn't give milk to her babies, couldn't feed them, and she was dying, and she was about to eat them, kill them, and that he gave his own body to give her sustenance to protect them. Right now, that seems like something that we couldn't do. Like Shantideva says in the beginning of the Bodhisattva Charyavatara, in the beginning, the Lord, the Bhagavan, the Buddha, taught us to give vegetables and so forth. You know that verse? Something like that. Later, so that later we will be able to give our own flesh. So right now we're not, like Shariputra, it's not the time to give our own body. It's the wrong time. It's the wrong time to give up your own, you know, like out of enthusiasm, you hear some lectures, I'm giving away my Prius, you know, what's it called? You've got the extra word on it.
Prime,
you know, I'm going to give my Prius Prime. I'm going to give away Matt, my son, and my daughter. No, but not their kids. They're too cute. It's not the right time right now for us. Perhaps giving physical possessions, not so long before we could give away. But to give our body, it's not the right time yet. But by giving other possessions and other things now and imagining that we might be able to do this in the future. So thereupon Indra and the other gods lauded him and all exclaimed in one voice, excellent, excellent, because by the words of truth he had caused his body to be reconstituted. Then the boy's father and mother and all of the people of that land came to where the boy was and were astonished. The king of that country, seeing this amazing feat of the boy prince, rejoiced greatly and believed, and taking the boy and his parents to his palace, showered them with countless honors. Actually, the father was the one who wanted to kill the mother, was eating. In compassion, he sent an army together with the king and the prince to their own country. Remember Rahula, the bad minister? They deposed the minister Rahula and made the king emperor. When he had ascended the throne, agriculture flourished and the land enjoyed peace. The Buddha then said to Ananda, Ananda, he who is now my father, Suddhodana. So remember, Siddhartha was born to King Suddhodana in Kapilavastu, his mother Mahadevi, under the Sala tree in Lumbini gave birth to him. So his father. He who is now my father, Suddhodana, was the emperor. That was the one who was going to kill the mother, right? She who is now my mother, Mahamaya, what did I say, Mahadevi, Mahamaya, was the queen, and I was the prince. Ananda, through the virtue of compassionately sacrificing my own flesh for my father and mother, and saving them from disaster in times long past, whenever I was reborn among the gods or among men, I was born in the supreme excellent lineage, whatever the highest lineage or, you know, status was, and became endowed with countless virtues. By the power of those virtues, I have attained perfect enlightenment. Those who had listened to the Lord tell one of his former birth stories of how he sacrificed himself for his father and mother were astonished. Some became stream winners, others became never returners, and all had faith and rejoiced greatly. Prince Svasti. I remember reading that, and I remember as a child, my mom and dad died many years ago. My mom died when I just, I think the year after, 2 years after I graduated from college. And my dad died when I, after the first year I was a monk or a bhikshu. So I didn't have a chance. And as a child, I didn't have the mindset that many people do of honoring my parents. It's just like, they didn't, you know, like the mindset of people, when we talk about the kindness of the mother, people say, oh, but my mother wasn't kind. You know, it's kind of like that mindset I had. And reading this and then seeing some of my colleagues, my Dharma friends, taking care of their parents, giving up, you know, even the, like one of my friends, Jeremy, giving up his education at the dialectic school to come back and take care of his dad who was now in the hospice with emphysema, the one who wrote Fairman, the book that we were reading. You know, the incredible kindness and sacrifice they did. Other people sacrificing, giving up other things, even their own practice and their own, you know, to take care of their parents. I developed some kind of change of mind, great regret for the neglect I'd taken with respect to my own parents. And I rejoice again and again when I think of this, not only when I think of this story, what amazing, how wonderful it would be to be like that, even to be like the other people who in the worldly view are just ordinary good people taking care of their parents. I rejoice in that. So we can see in all of these stories some opportunity to practice in some way. Even we can't give up our own body now, we can rejoice in that. We can rejoice in others sacrificing their own lives to take care of their parents, or we ourselves, as I know many of you take care of your parents and under sometimes great hardship. So that's next to offering to the gurus and the Sangha and the Buddhas, heaviest object of karma are your own parents. So if you can, you know, if you can practice that and rejoice in that, that's very, 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 very positive. It's our end time, right? 4:00?
4:30.
4:30. We still have a little time. So, before I start another story, any things have come up? Any questions, doubts, contradictions of what I said?
I go first?
Yeah, you go first. I thought you were going to sacrifice that first.
No, but...
no.
not my fault.
He sacrificed it.
I have questions from the last two stories before this one. Sure. The story before this one was the generosity of King Srisena.
Right.
And
you know what that means? Sri means glorious, like we say, Pelden Lamo, Sri Devi. Sri means glorious. Mm-hmm. And Sena, I think, means army. So just like a name, glorious army. Okay, Sri Sena.
And one of the lines in the story was, in the previous life, I attained the mind of enlightenment. It was just something he said to
right.
justify, I think, what he was going to do.
Yeah.
Two other people were asking. Does that mean he realized emptiness now? Or in a previous life he had and then lost it? Or?
No, neither. None of the above.
None of the above. Okay.
I remember one of my friends, childhood friend Dennis, he told me that he received some kind of recruiting postcard from the Marines. It says, the two choices. Yes, I want to serve my country as a patriot, and something like this, you know. And then the second one, no, I don't care about the. And then he added another box, none of the above. So the mind of enlightenment is bodhicitta. That's what it's another way of translating it. Citta means mind. Bodhi means enlightenment. Bodhicitta. So in a previous mind, in previous life, I'd developed spontaneous bodhicitta. I became a bodhisattva. I was entered the Mahayana path. Because of that, now I am continuing, you know, these bodhisattva practices. That's kind of the import of that, I think.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
And the other question is when you were talking about the four dhyanas.
Right. Not Diana's, right?
No,
yeah.
No, not, it's not a girl group.
New group, boy group, girl group.
It was mundane and super mundane.
Yeah, what's the difference between that? Go ahead.
My question was, would someone who had the mundane abilities lose them at death or over time, but someone who had the supra mundane abilities, super mundane vipassana, use it to develop emptiness. Is that the type of thing you might hold on to?
So the monks at the time when the Buddha was alive, Shakyamuni Buddha, many of them developed this, what I jokingly said, mind candy. Because in those realms, mind is very peaceful. It's not the overt joy that we experience. It's more and more like a neutral state of mind, but just like all distractions gone. So it's like the refuge. They may not achieve in that lifetime nirvana. They have this repose. They can go into entering that. That ability to have that state of mind may not continue into the next life if they pass away without having any other attainments. Or it might be there's a strong imprint of that they can easily achieve at the next lifetime, concentration, like some people. It depends on what they did with that, because once you achieve those concentrated states, those absorptions or dhyanas, Tibetan we say samten, there's a very common Tibetan name, Samten, you know, Geshe Samten or something like that. That means dhyana. So once you achieve that, it's kind of like the hot water with which you can use it different ways. You can make miso soup, you can make ramen noodles, you can make instant coffee, you know, tea. You can take a bath. It's a hot water. So with that, you can develop clairvoyance. You can develop divine eye, divine ear, and so forth. So it depends on what they did with it. Sometimes, like some of these people who are born that seem to know about the past or be able to predict about the future, they may have been people who created these states in previous lives. Now they don't remember that, but as an imprint of that, they still have some remnant of those psychic powers. They may not have the actual concentrated mind any longer. Even in this lifetime when they develop it, if they become distracted, they can fall from that. Now, if they were to develop the vipassana, the ability like the fish to go through the calm mind without disturbing it, and they apply that to meditating on the emptiness of the Four Noble Truths. So a different way of saying, in the Theravada tradition, they say, just meditating on the Four Noble Truths. But in the Mahayana, it says, the Four Noble Truths are your object of observation. How you're understanding them is empty of inherent existence. You're meditating on the emptiness of the Four Noble Truths. Anyway, so if you do that, it doesn't mean that that's called supramundane vipassana, but it doesn't mean you've reached a supramundane state yet. A supramundane state would be one in which you have become an Arya being. You've realized it directly. But it can lead, like the demarcation I said of the path of preparation
level
is when you have that tranquil abiding and penetrative insight, shamatha and vipassana, single-pointedly meditating on emptiness. So that's supramundane vipassana, because it leads you to a supramundane state. You're not yet in that supramundane state, and so you can fall from that. I mean, you can lose that concentration, but once you achieve the state of an Arya being, you've realized emptiness directly, that can't be lost. Some delusions, afflictions are ceased, abandoned from your mind, so they will never return again. And as you continue to meditate on that, on the path of meditation, ascending the various bhumis, so to speak, more and more of the subtler afflictions are ceased, so they'll never return again. Okay?
You're still accumulating karma?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, even when you no longer have any afflictions, you're still accumulating karma, uncontaminated karma.
Okay.
Right now we're accumulating contaminated karma, means the karma that we create, the actions we create, are motivated by a mind within which they're still grasping to true existence, contaminated by the grasping to true existence. So our actions, like I gave an example the other day at your house, if you had a nice new piece of wood, flat and sanded and everything, if you were to put sand on that and put a cloth on top and you rub that, it would leave some grooves in the wood, right? That's kind of like the movement of the mind. The sand is like the contamination of grasping to inherent existence. So that karma will only ripen within cyclic existence. It's called contaminated karma. That's the cause of our cyclic existence. Even virtuous karma you create, before you've realized emptiness, even the virtuous karma we create is called contaminated virtue. So it's not real happiness. It's just the results will always give you some relief from one thing, you know, contaminated, changeable happiness, right? A changeable suffering. With uncontaminated mind, the actions you create bring about results of uncontaminated happiness, you might call real Dharma happiness. So the Bodhisattvas, after they reach the stage of Arya, when they become an Arya being, they create uncontaminated happiness, create the cause of uncontaminated happiness when they have that mind. But their mind is still, until they reach a higher level, there's still some fault in the mind that leaves some little contaminated karma. Okay, now here's his turn.
I'm going to hold off on my question because I need to kind of rethink about it.
Okay, recalibrate.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm not sure it will come out the way I was.
Okay, and I forgot your name. Naga. You know what Naga means, right? Nag.
Cobra.
Can be. When I was in at Sarah, when we go to the fields, and they said, be careful, nag. Nowadays in India, they leave off the final A of the words that we often know as, like Ashoka. Ashoka was King Ashoka. The hotel in Delhi is now called Hotel Ashok. A lot of things are left, so they would just say nag, meaning cobra. Actually, naga can mean serpent, other serpents, but also refers to one of the rebirth states, you know, of technically located in the animal realm, but having incredible wealth. Sometimes certain spirits, when they do manifest in some form, they might appear as a serpent. Not all cobras and other snakes are nagas, but some can appear as snakes or serpents. They might inhabit some place like a tree or a stream, some clean place. And if you, like as a kid, maybe you make pee-pee on the tree or you put garbage in the clean stream, you can come down with all sorts of sores and problems. Nothing, no medicine cures. Only thing that can cure is like mantra, certain kinds of rituals that pacify the nagas that are afflicting you. I remember once at Copan, one of our monks, African-American monk, we called Yogi. Delster Pryor, he's still, he had gone to Sarah J afterwards. Anyway, American boy from Connecticut. And, he was helping the monastery after the rainy season repair the road and somehow offended a naga that was inhabiting the road. And he came down with, I don't know, sores on his arm. Nothing helped. He went into Kathmandu for medicine and nothing helped. And finally, Lama Lundup, who was one of the teachers at Copan, brought Yogi, as we call him, to the newly installed young tulku there at Copan, who now we know as Yangtze Rinpoche. Maybe some of you know Yangtze Rinpoche. Do you know Yangtze Rinpoche? Yeah. So he, that time he was a little boy. Right now he's very, very tall. That time he was very small. And when he was first, he was the reincarnation of a great teacher in Lhasa who was the guru of Lama Yeshe, Geshe Zopa, all of the, his previous reincarnation. He was even the guru of his father of this life. Anyway, that's another story. So, he brought him to this little boy and Lama Lundu said, just let Yangtze Rinpoche blow on your arm. He didn't say mantra or anything. And the next day, all of the sores were gone because this boy had bodhicitta. So, yeah, nagas are certain beings. It can be used colloquial in general in the dictionary. You can say serpent, but they're actually beings in the animal realm that are incredibly wealthy and powerful and can be beneficial, can be harmful. Anyway, naga, your question.
Naga, I see that cobra always protects me. So.
Good.
Yes. Any danger, I see the cobra, so I know somehow it's guarding somewhere. Thank you. The question was, you were saying that Aryas keep having the clarity of mind and they become upper level into the Bhumis, but then some of the Aryas, the big Buddhas, known, they are also doing something bad, right? Like
sometimes doing bad things?
Yeah.
Like what?
Like some of the monasteries, some of the famous Buddha teachers, we hear all the claims on them.
Yeah.
Well, so okay. How is that their karma changed?
So, though, if they did naughty things, they're not Buddhas, first of all. Even in the time of the Buddha, various monks who had looked like they had achieved arhatship, had become, you know, they'd reached nirvana. They hadn't really reached that state. They hadn't eliminated the delusions from their mind, and they might later, exhibit acts of attachment, you know, and anger and so forth. So sometimes in the in the different hearer traditions at the time, they said, oh, there, that arhats could fall from that state. But the Buddha said, no, that's not, this is the mudra I learned in Italy, right? You don't move, no, you don't move your hand, just its finger. Yeah, just, yeah, that's it. Yeah. it's, if you actually have cessation of the delusions, actual cessation, like you were asking about permanent phenomena, right, Joey? Was it Joey? Well, who was asking? Chris. Chris, right? He said, in the Abhidharma Kosha, it says, permanent phenomena are such things as space and the two cessations, including also emptiness and other things. So two kinds of cessation. Analytical cessations, when things are ceased, so they never return. And non-analytical cessations means, like these arhats, they may have ceased the delusions temporarily by applying some antidote, but when that antidote was no longer functioning in their mind, the delusion would come back again. So they weren't actually arhats. So same thing when you see people in the monasteries. I don't think anyone in the monasteries ever say they're Buddhas. So you might think, as a devoted Buddhist, you might think, you might say they are Buddhists. Oh, because they're Buddhists. Don't confuse Buddhist with Buddha. Right? We may be Buddhists because we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, but the monks and nuns in the monasteries and nunneries, even their teachers, may not be actual Buddhas. Maybe some of them are. The Buddha said in the future time, even in a degenerate age, we Buddhas will appear as teachers. So it's up to you to recognize us, even if we appear in ordinary form. So that's one, something very deep, sophisticated, esoteric practice, what we call guru devotion. Even seeing your ordinary teacher, even they have faults, you know, what was I joking before? They had tooth caca and ear caca, and they may have verbal faults, or they look like they have attachment, or they slurp when they're eating, and you know, oh, they can't be Buddha. Sometimes we don't have the karma to see actual perfect Buddhas. The only way they can appear to us is in some form which is ordinary. So that's one of the practices, very high practices of Buddhism. Although it's introduced often in Tibetan Buddhism at the beginning, and even to our students, what we call guru devotion, you know, to the spiritual guide, it's a very sophisticated, hard to understand practice. So it's not something you have to worry about now, but to the disciples of those teachers that might look like they did naughty things, they might try to practice to see, still, they did that out of compassion, the naughty thing. They may have done it for some particular reason. Like in the time of the Buddha, at first there were no vows of the monks. Before he even ordained nuns, there were just the monks. You just followed the Buddha. And then some of these followers did naughty things. And the Buddha said, okay, from now on, anyone who does that has broken a vow. He made the vows successively upon certain bad behavior coming up. Those people who did these naughty things, they may have been actually emanations of Buddha himself or great beings who consciously did these actions so that rules would be made so that other followers later would have guidelines. So you can't tell. Maybe the people who do even the wicked things and they bring into mind, you know, the rules and regulations and so forth, they may have done that for a purpose. But maybe that's beyond the realm of what we can conceive of right now. So just had a couple of minutes. One last burning question. Did you have something? Who didn't ask a question before? Chris, you have another question? Venerable?
No.
What did I say? Last call for alcohol. I heard that there was some, what was it, the Country Joe and the Fish? There was one in the refrain between one song and another, so something's blues music, and then someone in the background, you hear, last call for alcohol.
Maybe you can tell, help me to understand a little bit about this story. Sometimes I read through a lot of these stories. I'm struggling quite a bit about this story. How should we take these stories? Are they take it as a truth? Are they parables? Are they mystical events? Are they truthful events? So that all they are just created just to teach us something.
I think you could take most of those statements as all of that. Maybe not from a Buddhist perspective. For certain practitioners, they see these are actual deeds that did happen, that the Bodhisattva, the former lives of Shakyamuni, did perform, and that they were related later to his disciples. Other people who don't have that faith that the omniscient mind exists, that such things are possible, you know, that you could give your body or, you know, these things, they might take them as parables and interesting and useful and still appreciate them like parables. From a Buddhist perspective, I think we would accept generally that they actually happen. But there's even some people who call themselves Buddhists would not accept them. Like, what am I thinking of? Yeah, like whether the Buddha actually, some people say the Buddha didn't teach the Mahayana Sutras. Have you heard that?
Mm-hmm.
Only taught the Pali Canon. Because the Bodhisattva teachings, the Mahayana Sutras, are not enshrined in the Pali Canon. Therefore, the Buddha didn't teach them. But there's a great debate about that in the Mahayanas. They're chapters by the great beings. Nargajuna, Buddhapalita, Bhagavaveka, Shantideva, all have chapters in their books called Tekchen Kadup, establishing that the Mahayana is the word of the Buddha, you know, proving that the Mahayana was not just made up. And they would say, you Pali Canon, in the Pali Canon it says, the Hindu scriptures are not the word of Buddha because they're not found in the Pali Canon or something like that. They take the same, I can't remember that particular argument. Let me leave that aside. I'll try to figure that out. But they would say other things. There are several arguments like, say, without the Mahayana scriptures, although the Theravada, the Pali Canon, accepts the existence of Buddha and the quote, the Bodhisattva, usually they call the Bodhisattva, not Bodhisattvas, because they say it's the rare person who becomes a universal teacher. So this is almost like a unique thing. Although they have the existence of that, there's no indication in the Theravada scriptures of the vast deeds of the Bodhisattva, how to practice, other than the Jataka tales. In fact, they do. The Jataka tales are part of the Pali Canon. So some people would say the Mahayana is not the teaching of the Buddha, but others would say definitely it's the teaching of the Buddha. So there are many, many questions like that. Yours is whether these are to be taken literally or whether they actually happened or if it's just like made up or something. So similar kind of questions. I think for some beings who have a deep insight into emptiness, it's said that when you have an insight into emptiness, you see the possibility of all of these things happening. You know, there's not so much resistance, so much doubt in that. So, yeah, just last, what did they say? Last follow-up. Did you have a question? This gentleman behind, what's your name? Did you have a question? Oh, okay, you were just flotting away, swatting away a fly or something. Okay, so we've reached the time limit. I'd like to try to, I went over a little bit yesterday, I'd like to try to end close to time. So let's just finish with a short meditation, dedication. we can call it dedication on the back of a yak. Did I mention that to you?
Oh, yeah. Okay, hold on.
So there are sometimes when the lamas would come, you know, traveling, they'd be on the back of a yak to travel, and someone would bring out tanka. They'd go through a village, someone would say, oh, bless my tanka, bless my mala. Usually it would require some long consecration ritual. You know, they have to go into the house, make offering. So there were some texts that were called consecration on the back of a yak. That means while the lama's there, there's some texts you can remember by heart. They're very short. Just toss some rice. So we're going to do dedication on the back of a yak. That means not so long so that we go way over, but something still effective. So relax your mind, relax your body. Recall that we've created some virtuous karma this morning, this and this afternoon. Even if you got angry at lunch, you know, for saying something that was not politically correct or something, you may have regretted that later, so you created some virtuous karma. May these virtuous actions that I created by listening to the teachings, developing virtuous states of mind, and because it was motivated out of the thought at the very beginning that I'm going to listen to these teachings in order to achieve enlightenment for the sake of others, we've definitely created virtue that will ripen within cyclic existence. But dedicating that to the ultimate goal of our achieving enlightenment for the sake of sentient beings, it's like taking the reins of a horse, not letting the horse go wherever it wants, to the lower valley, clover field, or the river, or wherever it was. You're going to pull the reins, go in a particular direction that you wanted to go into. By your aspiration, by these virtues, may I quickly achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. Sometimes your mind freezes up. You can't remember what you're doing. Just remember, so these virtues I've created, they'll have an effect within cyclic existence. I'm going to invest those, like dedicate them. Like if you have a money, you're going to dedicate it, put it in some safe place so it's for your children's college fund or for your retirement or something. It's not going to be wasted on other things. May these virtues not ripen in other ways, but may they always become a cause of my spiritual development up to and including enlightenment for the sake of sentient beings. That's why I'm doing this. Okay, thank you very much. So we'll try again tomorrow morning. I think same time tomorrow morning, right? Oh, no. Tomorrow is different because I give a talk in the morning for the general. So it was suggested by Donna that I could, for the talk, the general talk, talk about Jataka Tale this Sunday. So if you're interested, you could also come then. It'll be a long day for you. But then we'll start at what time?
10:30. 10:30 to 12.
10:30 to 12
general.
And then
1:30 to 4:30.
1:30 to 4:30 is this continuation
correct
of this class. If you wanted to come to the morning session also, 10:30 to 12, but don't feel compelled. Thank you.